listeners, and welcome to yet another episode of Compare and Campaign. I am your host, Tom Lando, and with me, as always, is my co-host,
Miguel.
We are here, game masters, dungeon masters, storytellers, whatever you call a person that runs a role-playing game. That's what we are. We've done it a bunch of times, and we're, you know, through these episodes, just telling stories of old times we've run games, and we glean insights and reflections from our stories. We compare and campaign. It is episode 77 of Compare and Campaign. I believe just today our 75th episode is going up. We've been falling a bit behind, but you know, someone hacked my bank account. I got Dangus robbed. So, I didn't get robbed. I stopped it. I managed to catch it in time. But the point is, somebody tried to rob me, and that's been stressful. But I'll tell you something.
You say we're falling behind, but you know, the listeners, they'll never know.
I mean, that's the hope, is that we got to get this backlog going again. It's just like, you know, if this is 77 and 75 went up today. We're only like two ahead. Doesn't sit right with me, you know what?
Catching up to the present, that's the thing, is like we record well in advance so that we have a nice little buffer, but it's sort of like, it's almost like a time travel plot where the past is catching up to the present.
You know how I feel about having numbers at threes. So the fact that we're just, I guess we're within three of the one that went up today, so it's still okay, but like I just got that feeling we got to right the ship, you know? In the meantime, I also literally just about 15 minutes before we started recording, I finished listening to The Crystal Shard on audiobook, which I believe is the first of the Dritz novels to be put out. First book in the Icewind Dale trilogy. If that's what it's called, I don't actually remember. But yeah, it's something we had mentioned before, because I think it had been the answer, to one of the questions you asked me in the D&D quiz, was like, what's the first Dritz book? And it was The Crystal Shard. And now I've listened to it. I've basically read it. And, it was okay. It wasn't like... It's good enough. It's fine. It's not amazing, but like, it's not bad. And it's like, it's all very typical tropey kind of stuff, but like, it does it well enough. You know, I dug the part where the dwarf character, forges his like masterwork, which is a magic warhammer. What I liked is the idea there's this moment where it explains how the dwarf remembers his father basically telling him that one day he would forge an item so awesome that it's like it would be his peak, like he'll never do better than that, he'll never even be as good as that, and like he'll never really have the same passion for his work after he's made this incredible item, but this incredible item will be like indisputable in its quality. And so just like having that moment of the dwarf making the item, and I like that idea. Thought it was a neat scene.
This is the impression that I've gotten of like D&D books. I've never really read any of the D&D novels, unless like, do Dragonlance books count? I read some Dragonlance when
I think Dragonlance counts. They were the first ones, but I haven't read any Dragonlance. But I mean, I tried to read some Greyhawk stuff beforehand, and it was like, it was neat for the first little while, because I recognized, like, they're talking about the Council of Ernst and stuff, and I was like, hey, this'll be good, because of McGill's campaign that he's talking about in Greyhawk.
And then they went to Radagast City, and it all went downhill.
No, it's just like, I don't know. I liked it at first, and then like there's a scene with a pixie that I just... the character of the pixie was already like kind of like irking me, and then Yeah, it just like it just kind of went downhill from there.
So lukewarm opinions at best on D&D novels.
Well, I think I just think because I didn't even finish that one, and so like I finished the Crystal Shard, so like that's it's not that bad. There was another book I was listening to that was set in the Forgotten Realms, but the reader was no good. Because I've been listening to these on audiobooks, and like it had a, just a very grating voice. I didn't dig it. So, yeah. I don't know. Maybe that's...
They passed by Lucas, and then they went north, across the Forgotten Realms.
Wasn't like that, but...
Oh,
you know, I just I guess maybe the Crystal Shard is sort of like a mini, almost like a mini tavern pick for me here at the start of the episode because, you know, it's D&D related. I don't have huge opinions on it, but we can speak about it a bit because I just finished it. You know, it has a dragon gets slain. One thing I'll say is like by the end of the book they've set up an adventuring party that contains one dude from each of the common races. So Dritz is the elf, Brunor is the dwarf, Wolfgar is the human, and Regis is the halfling. But like, you know, it's a real sausage fest. And
no ladies, really?
Well, and the thing that's so weird about it to me is that the book introduces like an adopted daughter of Brunor who is like tough because she grew up like working for the dwarves in the mines, named Catti Bree. And I'm pretty sure from what I know that like later she goes on to be like a major figure. But it was strange to me, like, when she was introduced, I was like, oh, and she's part of the party too, right? But then, like, by the end of the book, it's pretty clear that she's not, which, like, you know, I'm sure is something that, like, has been, like, corrected in the series, but, because there's tons of Dritz novels now, but, point being, I just, like, you know, it was a bit, it's old fashioned is what it is. But I mean, the whole thing is I stopped listening to those Sharp books. Cause like, I find the author just leans so heavily on like the damsel in distress trope. It was just getting to be too much for me. So, you know, it's these little things that
this stuff has given fantasy a bad name.
Yeah. I don't know. It's again, the Crystal Shard was fine. So it's other stuff that's more disappointing.
Full disclosure, I can't hear the name Drizzt Do'Urden without thinking of like Dristan or some kind of medication for your sniffles.
I'm actually here's a topic is that, you know, have you ever voiced opinions about Drizzt Do'Urden on the podcast? I feel like maybe we mentioned him when we were talking about the D&D movie and maybe, I don't know, were we in favor or against the idea of maybe just doing one of the Dritz novels? But, like, I find that...
Well, I think we were in favor. The thing is, I don't actually have any strong opinions because I've never read a Dritz novel. I know the character, but I've never really, you know, taken part in any property that he factors big into, except for, like, a board game. I think there's a Legend of Drizzt, like, modular board game that's a dungeon crawl, but that doesn't really get into who Drizzt is. But I was in favor of doing a Drizzt story for the movie just because there's existing material. I think the point that we were trying to make is there's so much existing stuff in D&D. Why would you make up something new when you could just adapt one of the countless stories that already exists the fans really love? Or at least adapt a popular character.
Man, actually, I should look this up real quick. Okay, yeah. So, Another thing you had talked about with that movie was the idea of doing like the new Jumanji thing where it's like the kids get sucked into the game, right?
Absolutely, because I was inspired by the Kieran Gillen comic series Die, right, which is about a group of friends who get sucked into a role-playing game. Though in that case, it's not quite D&D. It's an RPG world that their friend created and that he got trapped in it as the dungeon master.
Well, I'll tell you what.
Why not do something like that?
Well,
and also, I was also saying it in the context of the D&D cartoon. They do the Jumanji thing, but it's not because they're playing D&D. It's because they go on the D&D themed roller coaster, which I think is the, like, why?
Yeah, Where did that come from? It's very bizarre, but I'll tell you this. I've found new reason for that idea to maybe be what they use in the movie as well. Because in fact, the first ever Dungeons and Dragons novel was actually Quag Keep, a novel based on the Dungeons and Dragons game by Andre Norton, based on his first experience playing the game, which told the story of seven gamers who were drawn into the fantasy setting.
Oh my god.
So, the first ever Dungeons and Dragons novel literally was a get-sucked-into-D&D story.
That's hilarious. I didn't know that.
So, it is the 10th of September 2021, and I, for episode 77, have Operation Winter Frost, which is an operation which is, or an adventure rather, which is very familiar to me, because it's it was based on a module that I've talked about before on the podcast, and which I've run more than once in more than one form, in one case for you and our Ashes Against the Grain group. Hey, by the way, I don't know if I ever mentioned, but Ashes Against the Grain is an album by the metal band Agalloch, which is why I named it that. And then Agalloch is the name of a huge, like, cursed forest in the south of Drail, in the Deathlands, that my main MPOC group right now is performing major military actions in that area. So, you know, it all keeps going. But
is there going to be a big reveal where we find out that Ashes Against the Grain is set in Drail?
Nope. Not doing that. But the point is, Foulness Beneath Molemaster, DDEX208, Dungeons and Dragons Expeditions Season 2, Episode 8 from the Adventurers League. Foulness Beneath Molemaster is this module that I've just, I find it's super simple, straight to the point, easy to run. It's great. It's got great, elements that you can sort of modify. And we'll get into all that as we get through my part of the episode. But meanwhile, what do you have for us, McGill?
It's another siege adventure this time. The players, the adventurers in Greyhawk, having moved on from the cursed area where they were trapped, being stalked by Jason Voorhees, essentially. They proceed south, and they come upon the city of Lukesh, where they were headed, only to find that it is under siege by Relt Sivord, the lord of the Northern Barbarian Kingdom, who has been spending his time still looking for the would-be assassins who tried to slay him at the beginning of the campaign. So it's finally happening, Tom. The big confrontation with Relt Sivord is upon us.
And he's going to be like, ah, you guys are all right. You got guts, kid. Et cetera, et cetera.
If they had had a more charismatic, like if they'd had a bard character in the party, maybe that would have happened.
Not just like a fellow barbarian. I guess they don't have that either.
Well, they do. They do. They have Kulka. But no, it does not go that way.
All right, well,
Also, at this point, they had, at this point, I think they were like, I think the players just wanted to kill him. Maeve had tried early on. Now she's like, I gotta finish this.
Matt, all right. Well, do you want to jump into it?
Sure, I can kick things off. So, you know, we start with with the party taking this overland route down the snaking curves of the Artun Same River south towards Lukish.
I was about to say Artun. One of the Artun. How's that spelled?
A R T O N S A M A Y. The Artun Same.
A R T O N. That's the dwarven city in Drail. That's the dwarven capital, and it's relevant to my game. I was like, dang it, stay in your own.
Oh well, there you go.
Stay your own game, Artun. Get out of here.
This is not my doing. This is just Greyhawk, man. I didn't make up the names. If I made up the names, well, it would be a whole other story.
So it's Artun Schmackmalorn, right?
Artun Same.
Hey, I got an S right.
I think Artun Schmackmalorn is a bit better, honestly.
That's pretty good.
So,
it's pretty good if I don't do say so myself.
They know that Lukish is one of the locations on the list that they have to work with. And it's like on their way back towards Greyhawk. So they are headed in that direction. And they make good time. They break from the river road, head southward through Ernst. And as they're heading up a rocky passage through some mountains, they see again smoke on the horizon. The last time this happened, it was last session. It was because they had come upon a settlement that had been raised by the barbarian fleet.
Did they see any smoke on the water?
No, and no fire in the sky either.
Oh,
no
man.
Sun smoke on the water even.
Yeah, that's true. I've already done this.
But they arrive on a plateau overlooking the lake near Div, and the lake is full of barbarian ships flying the crest of his grim and terrible might, Relt Sivord, Lord of the Northern Barbarian Kingdom. His looming warship, its masts like great black spikes, dwarfs the other ships. It's like a fortress. And of course, all the ships are focusing their might on Lukish. The players can see raiding parties rowing to shore in boats, clouds of arrows being volleyed from the ships close to land. Other ships are blasting the stone walls of Lukish with gnomish cannons. I made a point, I always love this, but I made a point of emphasizing that, you know, the players are far enough away that there's that eerie effect where they see the explosion and then there's a delay before they hear it. The players are all sort of standing on the plateau, and Eric goes, well,
counting their Mississippis to see how far away the explosion is.
Yeah, and Eric goes, well, I guess Istus intends for us to take on a whole army then. And so they go, all right, like, let's dive into it. They approach Lukish from the Eastern Road, and they're just, like, riding into a war zone. There are cannonballs that, like, whistle through the air, and buildings are sort of crumbling, smoke billowing behind the city walls. And the side of one city home... Or sorry, the side of the city that they're riding up to is home to sort of the poor section of Lukish, and they can see the raiders are like chasing down peasants and beggars and families. Some are being killed, some are being snatched up and taken prisoner, and it's just like a really alarming sight as these raiders are laying waste to this city. And the players decide, like, okay, well, like, draw swords. Let's wade into this battle and start saving people. And I didn't run this one. I talked about running a siege adventure back when we did, back when I was doing the Verdant Apocalypse campaign. And I didn't do it like that because the players aren't really defending this city. Instead, I had this as sort of a... a series of directed combats.
I would also think that, like, narratively, you can just place at any moment the point when one of these barbarians recognizes that, like, this, like recognizes Maeve as the assassin that he's been looking for all this time, right?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
At any point, you can make the call that they're, like, the Vikings are suddenly like, wait a minute, look at their cloak or whatever, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I have that in my back pocket, but I didn't really even have to use it because the players, they were out for blood. Like, there was definitely, they all had it in mind where they were like, this is it. We're here to kill Relt Seaboard. Like, this is our chance. We finally crossed paths with him again, and we're going to do it no matter what. So, like, their mission, even though they would get sidetracked, sort of going like, okay, we got to defend, you know, this family from these raiders, or we got to save that house from being burned down because they see raiders with torches and all that. Like, they had these sort of little side missions as they went, but the overall sort of motivation that they all had was just like, this is our chance. Let's take him out. Let's make sure that he doesn't hurt anybody else, and also sort of finish what we started way back at the beginning of the campaign. All of, like, at this point, it was probably close to 20 sessions ago. This is the 16th chapter that I've done on the podcast, but a few of the adventures I've described are sort of like condensed, you know, versions of adventures that took place over multiple sessions. So I'd say probably around this point, they were around session 20 in this campaign. So they had, you know, 16 to 18 or so sessions go by since the last time they crossed paths with Relt Seaboard, and they were like, this is it. This is the confrontation. Let's do it. And so the way I ran this is the Fate of Istis module just has a map of Lukish with the with like the full legend of all the different notable locations. And there is like a western road that leads into the city. You can see there are gates, and then there are settlements just outside the city walls, and then there's the main city wall. The main city wall that encompasses sort of the central areas. Like, there's a racetrack, there's a city garden, there's a big dining hall and all that. And so I presented the players with this map, and I let them sort of pick the direction they were going in. And I just had a bunch of small encounters prepared based on where they were going. So, like, if they head to the beach, you know, two more raiding boats make ground on the beach. The raiders ignore the combat and instead head for the wooden gates to the city, and they're trying to tear down the city gates on the eastern side. And so, you know, the players rush over to the opposite side of those gates and try to defend them. Lots of little encounters like that. And what I did here is, I think I've talked before about, I know I've talked before about, like, fighting swarms and fighting groups of enemies and the ways to do that so that it doesn't just become a slog where you have to pick off every individual, especially in a big battlefield setting like this one. And so I found a template. I wish I could remember where, but I don't. I just sort of copied and pasted it into my notes because, of course, at the time I wasn't thinking I'd ever have to cite my sources. But I found a creature template called the Bloodthirsty Buccaneers, and this is a template it's like a monster template for groups of buccaneers, and they have collective hit points of 170, but you have to imagine that it's like, I don't know, maybe 10 buccaneers or so in a group, and they've got sort of all the standard traits. And saving throws, and they have a stat block and everything. And then they have a few special traits and a couple of actions that I'll read here. The special traits, sneaking surround, any creature ending its turn adjacent or within two or more squares that the crew occupies. The crew can then deal them 21 piercing damage. So, like, if you wind up too close to this group of buccaneers, they stab you.
Is that like within a certain reach, or is that when you're within the group of buccaneers?
Both. you're adjacent or within two or more squares that the crew occupies.
It just, the rules remind me of the way that, like, swarm units tend to work in 5th edition now, which is, like, you typically have an action that the swarm will take on someone who they are, like, in the same square as, basically, on the grid. Mm-hmm. Or they can attack things adjacent to them. And then, I don't know, do they have the other thing, which is, like, a swarm in 5th edition typically... It does twice as much damage. Like, basically, you'll have a unit that does, say it has 30 HP and does 2d6 pierce for a bite normally for, like, a swarm of piranhas. And then, if you get it down to 15 HP or lower, then it starts doing 1d6. Like, it cuts in half because there's less things in the swarm. Does it have a thing like that?
It doesn't, but that's actually really a clever feature that I wish I had added to that. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, you could basically have, like, the Buccaneers starting to get thinned out, be represented on their stat line, similar to, like, horror clicks.
That's smart, yeah. I like that the damage goes down the more hits they take, because, of course, it is not just a single enemy, but a group. The other traits that these Buccaneers have, the troop can occupy another creature's space and vice versa, and the troop can move through any opening large enough for a medium humanoid, so they can sort of like file through a bottleneck if they need to. And then they have two special actions. One they can perform 3 times a day, which is the troop drinks rum spiked with healing potions. So as an action, 3 times a day, they can collectively heal 3d8 hit points and remove some of the conditions, blinded, deafened, exhausted, or poisoned. And then the other action they can take is a vicious offense, which is a melee attack. It does a bunch of slashing damage, and they can break that up among different targets. So they can either deal like a big amount of damage to a single target, or they can divide it up into a series of 1d4 attacks against all the targets that are within reach of them.
That's cool. And, that makes sense.
Yeah. And so I used these Buccaneers to just represent just groups of raiders and barbarians. Anytime more than one player came upon something that was going down, I would use these Buccaneers. If it was one player, I'd pull up sort of a generic barbarian NPC and maybe have like one or two of them, just so that the players are never totally overwhelmed. But whenever like all four of them were fighting, I'd throw them against the bloodthirsty Buccaneers. And so as they fight these Buccaneers, I have a few things going on. I mentioned already that the Buccaneers are, the barbarians are trying to tear down the walls around the city, break in through the gates. Walls have clearly been breached elsewhere. Men from Seaboard's fleet can be seen wreaking havoc. And then in the midst of the fray, the players come upon a squad of knights holding their own against the encroaching horde, and they're led by two people who they can easily recognize as heroes. One is a woman with black hair and this like stony expression on her face. She wears a hood and tattered gray robes in multiple layers, and she's armed with an ornate staff that's topped with a spearhead, and she's casting a lot of spells. She's obviously some kind of magician. And then the other is this guy who is of some nobility. He has sort of an Errol Flynn look. He's dressed in green finery with silver brocade. He has a gleaming rapier in one hand and a buckler in the other. The sword blade emanates bright light, and they recognize him as he's the count that has the healing amulet that they encountered back in Jern.
Oh,
so
that guy.
He's wound up here defending. Yeah, he's wound up here defending Lukish. And so the players join up with their group and they combine forces and start like pushing back the attack. And this is also something that I would do is I do these, they're not like timed events, but they're sort of like responsive events where anytime it seemed like the heroes were really like they're on the offensive, they're managing to push things back. A cannonball would like rip through a house or, you know, smash through a tower or something and just sort of wreak more destruction on the city. But now that they've met up with these new people, I had it so that when this happened, the mage twirls her staff and she slams the butt of it into the ground. And then with a boom, the raiders are blown back by an unseen force. And then debris from, you know, whatever building is crumbling, it like falls all around some protective force field that she's cast. You can see it sort of bouncing off of an invisible bubble surrounding, the heroes and the people they're defending. And, So Count Lance is the healer of Silverwood. We've met him already. And this woman introduces herself as Akona, who is an archmage who prays to Istis but doesn't belong to an order. And I have some quotes from her here where she goes like, "Order? Orders provide anything but order. That's what doing things by committee will get you. A lot of questions without answers." So they like combine forces and start ridding the main part of the city of barbarians. It was a lot of sort of prolonged combat sequences trying to push back the army.
Was there any tension between Maeve and this new character?
Not immediately. You'll see how it goes down, but there is some that occurs sort of the longer they are together. So the big thing that happens here, of course, is the confrontation with Relt Seaboard. There are all these like small skirmishes that take place until I think it was Eric, spots that Relt Seaboard and his little raiding boat with a party of barbarians has landed ashore. They land off the like on the northern beach of Lukesh, and they come ashore and. The players see this from a distance, so they start like closing the distance to get towards him. But they're kind of in the middle of the city, and he's on the upper edge of the city. And they watch as he goes into Lukesh Castle, which is like right on the waterfront. They follow him inside and like spread out trying to search for him. And it was Eric who finds him first. Eric heads up like upstairs and finds the King of Lukesh in Relt Seaboard's grasp, and like Seaboard turns and looks at Eric just as Eric comes to the room and just stabs the king right in the guts and throws his limp body to the ground. And Eric like calls for his friends, everybody piles up into this room, and the battle begins. Close quarters combat with Relt Seaboard. Hulka rages out and just goes nuts. I'm pretty sure Stash leapt on Relt Seaford's back and started like trying to backstab him that way, while the other three party members fought him directly. And it was one of those like long, hard-won battles where they basically destroy this room. It's the king's bedroom that the king was hiding in, and they just destroy the whole room as they're fighting Relt Seaboard. But it was one of those things. They chip away at him until he's dead. I'm just gonna look here. I'm trying to remember. I know I had stats for him. I just wonder if I have them at the ready so that I could pull them up.
Did you make up your own stats for him, or did you like get them from like a source?
I found them online. One of the things that I love, I can't seem to find them just offhand, but one of the reasons that I like working in an existing setting like Greyhawk or Eberron is that a lot of these things are pre-written. Like, I have stats here for Yuz the Evil.
It's funny because we were talking about Dritz earlier, and I was thinking, because I feel like Dritz has, like, a negative reputation just generally among, like, D&D players. But, you know, listening to that novel, I think that... I mean, the character didn't bother me too much in and of himself, although it's like a very cliched kind of thing, is like the guy from the evil world who's trying to be good. You know, like he's a stranger in a strange land, you know, basically, you know, like countless other characters like Worf and whatnot, who are like, you know, go against the stereotype of their species. But I feel like one of the things I was kind of watching for is like, well, it seems like Dritz like never really loses his fights, but he does have like clearly delineated weaknesses, particularly in that like he has the drow weakness of sunlight sensitivity. And so that is like something that is incorporated into the narrative. But I feel like no matter what Dritz is portrayed like in the books, the real thing that draws the enmity of players towards him, I think, is just the idea that there's a character in Dungeons and Dragons that like is the best, that can't be killed, basically. It's like, if you put Dritz in your campaign, there's going to be like this urge probably from players that recognize him to like make their character the one who slays Dritz Doerden. What, how crazy would that be?
Yeah, I think that's a valid concern.
It's something that people love to do in the first Baldur's Gate game as well, I think, or whichever. I think it's in Baldur's Gate 1 where you can meet Dritz, but he's like an insanely difficult fight. And so people have like figured out different ways of beating him. One of them being to just like swarm him with skeletons to the point where he can't like get away, basically. Just slowly wear him down. Anyways, that was just my thoughts about like characters that exist in the fiction of D&D. It's like Relt Seavord. He's an even juicier target because he's like canon, basically.
Right. But, you know, it's funny because I don't think the players knew that. That's one of the other things is unlike a character like Drizzt, my players hadn't really delved into.
So you didn't make it clear to them at all, like how huge this guy was.
No, I didn't. Nor I don't really do that. Like, I'm running a campaign in Forgotten Realms, and anytime an existing sort of like a pre-built character, pre-built NPC who's a part of that setting pops up, I never really point out that this is like a big deal or anything. I treat them just like any other NPC. And I mean, I think that's why Maeve tried to assassinate Relt Seavord, is just because she was like, okay, Barbarian King, he's obviously evil, let's take him out, I'm a paladin.
Not realizing
that this guy has like 20 levels of barbarian.
I am remembering though that like when they initially identified Relt Seavord, it was Hookah who gave the description, is like great barbarian leader, yeah, and everything.
But that's because I fed her that information.
But like it seems that like the impression was not left very strongly on the party, because like I totally agree with that sort of thing where like you want the characters to have the information that they as people in this setting would have. But yeah,
I'm pretty sure all Hookah really said was like, he is a barbarian king. But yeah, not like, he is an all-powerful barbarian king who rules this entire region.
They were like, barbarian kings are probably cheap dollar store kings. There are probably plenty of them, whatever.
We can take him. One of the funny things, though, is I think...
Maybe they misheard and they thought it was barbarian Viking. And they were like, yeah, whatever.
Honestly, if I had to guess, I think what actually happened there, I think the whole reason that they tried to even attempt an assassination against a barbarian lord so early in the game is, I think it was one of those cases, this has definitely happened to me, where they had come off of a different campaign where they had reached a really high level. So everything seemed really easy. I'm pretty sure that Cater was just like, yeah, we can take him. Last game I played, I could take this guy. Forgetting, of course, that he was suddenly back at, like, level one.
I don't know if you forget that kind of thing, but maybe. I don't know.
You'd be sort of, I have forgotten that kind of thing. I've totally, like, especially when you've been playing one campaign for, like, months and months and months, and then it ends and you start a new one, you're still in the mindset where you're like, I can take on epic level characters. Yeah.
I mean, that's not my experience at all. I'm very keenly aware of how vulnerable I am once I'm back down to level one.
The record was definitely set straight very quickly.
Missing all my amazing powers. My DC isn't, like, nearly unbeatable. Ah.
They fight Rout Seaward and they win. It is hard won. It is a big battle, but they win. And
I assume the fact that they outnumbered them gave them, like, they outnumbered him gave them something of an advantage.
Yes. And at a certain point in the battle, what ended up happening too is that that half of them, I think it was Hulka and Maeve, focused on Relt, and then Stash and Eric started holding off barbarians who were trying to enter the room. But they managed to do it. They managed to kill him because they outnumber
him. Actually,
they're...
that reminds me of when the Puff the Messed Up Dragon, when Al's Aces were fighting the, like, all messed up undead dragon that was all hooked up to, like, pipes and machinery and was all diseased and stuff. Remember, Chessie got on the dragon and, like, was focusing on it while, like, Nessalie shot it at it from behind, but then Ara was, like, blocking the side doors so that, like, none of the other soldiers could get in.
Yeah. They slay Relt Seaward, and I distinctly remember that this was Steve's idea, this was Eric's idea, where he goes, we are bringing his body to the top of this castle, and we are hanging it off the front for his entire fleet to see. And so they did that. They hauled Relt Seaward's body up to the top of the castle, string it up with ropes, and, like, hang it from the battlements so that his fleet can clearly see that he has died. And it doesn't stop the siege right away, but it definitely starts, like, slowing it down as more and more of the raiders realize that their leader has been killed. And in these moments of calm, this is when Akona the Mage approaches them and says, like, we have to go. We have a lot to discuss. The High Order of Istis thinks that, you know, the Grey Maiden herself has time for these prophecies and pendulums, but that's just not how Istis thinks. She isn't a commanding voice telling you where to go, or even a guiding hand. She is the destination, and we have to get ourselves elsewhere so that we can properly figure out what's going on and turn the tables in this, basically, what is a celestial war against Yuz. And this is where tensions started to arise between the party and Akona, because Akona goes like, all right, gather close. And she starts casting a spell. And both Maeve and Eric were like, wait, no, we're not leaving yet. And as soon as they say that, boom, she's dimensional doored everyone away to a different location. And the session ends right there. And I remember both Steven and Cater being like, what? No, like, they were so angry that she just sort of, like, booped them somewhere else without consulting them first. And so they are, like, they're off. They're off to parts unknown at the end of this session, leaving behind sort of the aftermath of this siege. And also Count Lance, the healer of Silverwood, is still there. So presumably, at least the city under siege still has some help. But I remember they were all, like, it was a real rug pull. Everyone was like, no, wait, no. And then they were gone.
I got another comparison for our two campaigns. Know what this reminds me of? This tension.
What's that?
What's her name? What's the mage's
name? The mage?
Akona. I kept thinking Ako, Anko. I'd already forgotten it. Okay. But this reminds me of Akona reminds me of Serpentine, the character that was recently introduced to Al's Aces, and her whole thing about, like, we're not supposed to be following these dumb steps, we should be going straight to Istis. It's just like Serpentine's thing about how we shouldn't be doing what Al says, we should be looking for Odium.
Very similar. This is the point in the Destiny of Istis campaign where the tables do turn a bit, where the players gain more agency and they stop being like led around by the nose and decide, okay, no, we're going to be proactive here. We're going to make our own path rather than following these breadcrumbs that have been set out for us. And frankly, it's the kind of thing I was hoping that they'd do a bit earlier and of their own accord, but we got to this point where I was like, okay, now they need to sort of be knocked off the path. And so I threw in some NPCs to help them do it.
Do you think anyone thought, or do you know if anyone thought that Akona might have been Gargrath?
Morgarath.
Morgarath.
Absolutely.
I'm not
there was
afraid
a lot of
remember
suspicion.
Names a lot.
There was a lot of suspicion. Anytime a new NPC was introduced, who they had, like, they didn't suspect Count Lance because they had met him before. They met him before in the context of Morgarath trying to assassinate him. So they were like, okay, he's fine. But yeah, Akona, they were like, who is this person teleporting us away in the middle of a battle? Like, not cool. We're not at all cool with that. So there was definitely a lot of suspicion of who Akona was and what her motivation was.
So, is that your half of this podcast?
It is.
Well then, let's head on over from Artin Schmackmagal to what was it?
Artin Same, I think it's Artin Same.
From Artin Same to just plain old Artin. When last we left off, our heroes in the northern highlands of Drail in the mountains, they had, you know, they're continuing to deal with the cult of Krynax. They haven't been able to confirm if the cult of Krynax is under the thrall of Sileth the War Witch, but they've got their suspicions. And they found the cult of Krynax up to some skullduggery all over the mountains from misleading monks who are trying to go to a monastery to, you know, digging up this mysterious old dragonborn that's trapped in a stone with an old inscription on it. Then, of course, the other thing is that in a little sort of sidetrack, the previous operation, the players had also encountered a tree that had been twisted by the influence of an elemental node. And so the presence of elemental nodes, just as it is in the Princes of the Apocalypse campaign in the Forgotten Realms, it is a factor which, like, the sheer power of the elemental nodes brings a supernatural element into the material plane and sort of, like, it messes with the natural world around it, basically. So now that they know that these elemental nodes are around, which explains the presence of, like, a tree with wasps in it in the middle of the winter, then you have another thing caused by the presence of elemental nodes, which is a heat wave sweeps through the mountains in the middle of the northern Draelic winter. And,
heat wave, burning my heart.
So all this snow is getting melted, and suddenly you're going from, you know, it's supposed to be Winterfest, but then all of a sudden it's hot, humid. It's like dang old wet, hot Draelic mountains summer around here, but it's winter.
It's like winter around here now.
I mean, I guess. I'm not
Or at least when I lived in Toronto. When I lived in Toronto, there's this weird thing that happens where every January for about a week, Toronto just gets hit by like summer weather. It's all warm, everything's really nice, and then it goes back to awful winter.
It's the cult of Cryonax and their elemental nodes, McGill.
I guess. A lot of my friends just call it Fool's Spring.
Fool's
You think it's spring.
Spring.
You think it's spring, but it's not. It's still winter.
There was a comedian, I think he was from Ontario, Jeremy Hotz. Do you remember him?
No, I don't think I know his work.
His whole bit was that he would kind of do his... He's still around, but like he's not as relevant anymore, I don't think. But his whole bit is like he would deliver all his bits like into his mouth, like he was trying to like stop himself from laughing at something. Like, can you believe that? And he'd say that everything was miserable. I just moved to Toronto. What a miserable place that is.
Sounds like Emo Phillips.
But there was one of his things, the whole thing of like, move to Toronto and like some people from Toronto cheer and he's like, what a miserable place that is. Whole city smells like poop for a quarter of the year. I don't know where it came from, but the whole city smells like poop. Who's been pooping all over the city? So yeah, it's probably all the poop comes out from the Fool's Spring, is what I'm saying.
You know, that makes sense.
Yeah. Anyway, so there's a heat wave, there's a Fool's Spring caused by elemental nodes up in the mountains, and it sweeps through the holds of the dwarves and the draconics and the avians that call the mountains home, that live in their holds within the mountains. And the draconics and the avians, of course, also live above, but you know, the dwarves are right in there. So that's where the party is, Al's Aces. This is gonna sound familiar because you know Foulness and Mole Master. In the sewers of the dwarven city of Arten, a strange carcass has been discovered. And so the Aces are called in, and Chessie identifies the dead creature as a flumph. Love me a flumph.
So, I gotta say, I'm kind of excited to hear how this one goes, because you ran a variation of Foulness Beneath Mole Master for the campaign that I was playing in.
And I didn't even have the flump in that variation.
Yeah, I was gonna say, it did not involve a flump. And I had, at that point, I was completely unfamiliar with this module. So it was all new to me. But then, when I was looking for inspiration for a module to run for some of my players, you recommended Foulness Beneath Mole Master to me, and I ran it with the flump involved. I just sort of, I mostly stuck to what was there, but added in a
few of
my own touches.
I'm kind of interested in like doing this step by step. Is like, what did you do at this part? That sort of thing.
Yeah, and so now I'm curious to see how you ran it this time around, because it sounds like you're maybe a little closer to the way it was written in the module than you did when you ran it for me.
You can also follow along in the doodles that we'll be providing in the comparing campaign, because I have one of those side-on maps of the whole experience with all the little characters and the DC. So early on, you got a picture of Ara and Nessaly and Chessie. You can see that Ara's got his Trident of Warning on his back, and he's got his Chaos Maul in his hands, and he's got his Helm of Comprehend Languages on. And then Nestle's got got one of the new Artemis carbines, the M1A1, because you can see she's mounted a bayonet on it, which I was going to say, the bayonet feature on that I have on those guns, I would effectively... There's one of the traits that a weapon can have. I think it's light. I think I went with light, not finesse. But the point is, my ruling was like any... blade basically that had that trait could be used as a bayonet, which basically allowed Nessaly to mount her like weapon of choice on her rifle, regardless of whether she was using like a dagger or a short sword, for example. So Nessaly's got her rifle, she's got her trioptics, her gas mask and everything, her Kevlar, and then she's got her rifle with the bayonet, and then Chessie has, of course, her staff of defense, her slippers of spider climb, and her rapier. And then you see the next thing over, a little Draelo tapestry. Got a flump with like dripping off the table, hanger off the table, flies hanging around, stink lines. He's got big X's over the eyes.
I like your rendition of this flump.
Yeah, I mean, in general, I was about to say, like, you can see in these pictures, I've got my, like, doodles of flumps in general. Like, in the other image that I've included, there's just sort of, like, a lineup of different doodles, and I have the flump there. And, yeah, one of my big things with the flump is, like, I like the idea that the flump is very slimy and has, like, a big floppy tongue. It's all slimy that hangs out. I just think that's funnier.
And they make fart noises.
I mean, maybe they're just blowing raspberries in my version.
In the write-up for the flump, though, it's pretty explicit that it can, like, jet away. Or it's not even in the write-up for the flump. It's in the module for Foulness Beneath Mulemaster, where there's, you know, you hear the expulsion of air through a fleshy sack. And of course, it's, you know, it makes a noise.
And it's funny. I was also gonna say, because we mentioned that time that I in Ashes Against the Grain that I ran the module, and in that case, it's funny because the ways in which I had changed the module were entirely tailored towards the development of our friend Jess's character, Lelenia, who was playing this like psionic sorceress basically. And what's funny is that there's like a similar to the different options for like your character background, like your character's ideals and flaws and whatnot. There was a table similar to that in the sort of experimental supplement that she got that psionic sorceress class from. And in that table, there's a table of basically origins that you could have gotten your like psionic talent from. And one of the options is basically like, not explicitly, but fairly implicitly, it's like you had an imaginary friend that helped you when you were young, and now you seem to have like retained some of their abilities, but it has just enough detail to imply that the imaginary friend looked like and probably actually was a flump, so that then you can then meet the thing and it turns out it's not an imaginary friend at all. And I had like that whole idea had just inspired me to do the sort of more Lovecraftian backstory for Lelenia, where she had this background involving fish people, the Kuo-Toa. But yeah, it should be said that like the lineup there was also quite perfect, where it's like this is a flump adventure and there was a flump background basically ready for the character. And I had planned from the beginning to use this adventure in the sequence of adventures I used for Ashes Against the Grain. So it all worked out really nicely, with me just sort of like pulling the strings according to how I wanted things to play out.
And it's a great module. Just a fun one to run anyway.
I also just want to say, on the topic of Ashes Against the Grain, when we played our most recent sessions of Ashes Against the Grain, you guys were faced with a fortress that backed onto a sheer cliff, and we had beforehand literally done the episode where I said, you know what happens with cliffs, the fortresses that back on to sheer cliffs, is there's a dang old cove or something down on the
secret
cliff.
Secret passage.
But I really appreciate the fact that you didn't immediately just start looking for it like I had suggested in the episode. You just, like, played it cool.
It's called role-playing, man. That is the great challenge, right? You gotta play what your character knows, not what you know as a player.
I guess Nox just doesn't know the coast well enough.
Nox doesn't know civilization well enough. He is not so smart.
So, the players are sent down into the sewers of Arten, where this Flumph corpse has been found. See what the heck's going on. Who the heck killed a Flumph? A Flumph is a creature of good, so it's immediately suspicious. Although, in the original module, it's set in the terrible city of Mulmaster. So really, you know, the people in that city wouldn't know good thing if they bit him in the ass. I don't think the guard sergeant is, like, that receptive to the fact that it's a Flump. But if you pass the check to identify it, then you can be like, oh, these are good guys. Why would somebody be killing a Flump? So the party descends into the sewers, which holds the risk of sewer plague. Most importantly, if they take damage while they're down here, there's the chance that if they step into the gross-ass sewer waters, their wounds will get infected with sewer plague, which I kind of almost played more for comedic purposes in Ashes Against the Grain as, like, the thing of, like, really the only consequence was going to be that later on you'd have terrible, like, dysentery, basically, and need to have, like, the local cleric who sent you on the job come and have a look at you. I don't think that, like, much like in Ashes Against the Grain, I don't think that the players ever actually got sewer plague in the course of this adventure, but it was a risk, and I think it's, like, it's an interesting detail of the module that they include just to, like, help flesh out the sewer. So here's another thing that I totally took out when we were doing Ashes Against the Grain, but I left in when I was running it for Al's Aces, is there's a part in the module where you find, where the players run into some adventurers that are already down in the sewers, and, like, they've had a something's gone wrong, they've lost one of the people in their group. It helps to foreshadow some of the threats that are coming out. Like, there's a sort of part of the sewer that's prone to flash floods, and there are enemies up ahead, although the party doesn't warn exactly of the specific enemies that the players will be facing. But, like, so in Ashes Against the Grain, to me, this felt like just, like, a holdup. I wanted to focus on your characters. We also, like, with Ashes Against the Grain, I think I have a bit more of an impulse to keep things short, basically. Like I would prefer, I think in the first module I ran with the carnival, that one we managed to complete the whole session in 4 hours, and, like, I was super pleased with that. And so, like, I'm always trying to fit sessions neatly into the 4 hours for the benefit of Ashes Against the Grain, whereas I'm a little bit more self-indulgent as a DM when I'm doing my big MPOC game. I skipped this thing where you run into other adventures in Ashes Against the Grain, but then for my MPOC game, this is something I had mentioned before as well, is, like, you know, you have the different factions of the Forgotten Realms are sort of catered to in each Adventure League module. You'll get side objectives for specific members of factions, or specific information for different members of factions, different plot hooks that could be used to draw them in. But I had mentioned when we talked about that in my version of these modules, it's like every faction is basically just the MPOC. And similarly, the idea of having other adventurers down in the sewers already, what I incorporated that into my game as was there were some MPOC, like some lower ranking MPOC agents who were already in the sewers that were like missing in action that the players managed to meet up with and like help them get out of the sewers before they continued into their mission proper.
I also omitted that part of it when I ran it. The other group of adventurers didn't need it.
You know, there's also a funny detail here that you can see in my notes is like basically all the NPCs have three-letter names, which like is a rule that I like to use for my goblin characters because it's like it seems fun and goblin. Like, why would a goblin waste their time with a lot of syllables? But also at this point, and like I think still, I have like a list of sort of like I have like a complaint with I think it's Xanathar's Guide to Everything, one of the better supplements that's been put out for the 5th edition. It has all these lists of tables of random names at the back of the book, but they're all based on like real world ethnicities, and it's like, should they have tables for like the Forgotten Realm ethnicities? I mean, I could give this guy a Spanish name, but like, what kind of name is someone from Luskin supposed to have, you know? I could probably guess it. The point is, like, because of that oversight, those tables, like, those name tables fall short for me. And so I have my own name table, but for a long time it was just full of three-letter names because, you know, why make things complicated? Why make my players have to remember the difference between Doran Damien and Conflandador?
One syllable's enough.
Yeah, so, you know, I was working my way through that list when I did this operation, and I'm still working my way through this list. I've finally gotten, like, a lot of the three-letter names off and have started to get into, like, other names. So, like, for the adventurers they ran into, these MPOC agents, they ran into Ike, Ain, and Jack, some missing MPOC agents. Also, in the doodles, not only can you see them, but you can also see the entrance to the art and sewers, and then you can see all the little stink lines and flies to show the sewer plague was there. So they run into these guys who give them some idea of like what to expect in terms of like flash floods in the sewers. Which even when I ran it for Ashes Against the Grain, I had a whole other justification for the flash floods, which was that like it was extra incentive to solve the problem of the Kuo-Toa being dead, because I wanted the dead Kuo-Toa to be the problem to be solved in the case of Ashes Against the Grain. So in that case, I said that their corpses were like causing blockages, which would then lead to these like sudden influxes of like flooding sewer water. Whereas like the justification in the original module is simply, well, this is a flump, it's a good guy. And also, so coming up eventually, I'm not there yet, but like eventually the dead flump's mate is supposed to arrive and introduce itself to the player and really give them like a sense of what's going on. But what's funny is that the module seems to be like knowingly designed with the awareness that like you can easily do a very different type of adventure if that flump isn't there, because if the living flump is there to explain things to the players, they don't have a lot of reason to like go along with the evil cultists that they run into later. But if, as in the case of Ashes Against the Grain, you don't have any of that explained to you, that run-in with the cultists can be interesting because they have provided like role-playing tips and a backstory and personality for the leader of the cultists. Like, he is designed as if they were aware that there should be a version of this module or a possibility to run this module where the players don't just immediately attack the cultists because they're evil cultists, even though if you have the flump there to explain things, it's probably what I think the players would do. In my case, since I have the benefit of the sort of MPOC structure, it's like they are already going into this looking for cultists of Cryonax causing trouble, and so they don't have a lot of trouble identifying these bad guys, flump or no, though I did include the flump. So after navigating through the sewers, they sort of have to simultaneously deal with the threat of this flash flood, but also a group of Lacedons, which are aquatic ghouls in Dungeons & Dragons, who are basically laying low in the sewer water. So you can have this sort of classic horror moment of the corpses like bursting out of the water and attacking your players. Lacedons,
yeah, my players also did not like that at all.
Oh, they didn't like it? They didn't like getting attacked by the sewer people?
Well, they didn't like it in that it freaked them out. They weren't expecting
the chuds.
Yeah, got a big reaction.
Man, that's dope. Yeah, it's funny because these Elemental Evil campaign related adventures, like this module, I found that they used Lacedons a lot in these various modules, and it's kind of obvious why, because you know, you've got the elemental cult of water, and so it's an easy setup to be like, oh, one of their evil water rituals is they drown their victims in these chambers, and then when they release them, these like enchanted chambers, that then when they're released, they come out as Lacedons that they leave as like mindless guardians, basically, to like guard their backs and whatnot when they're up to no good. But yeah, you see, like even because of that context, you see the Lacedon bursting out of the water, like the hidden Lacedon with the perception check to detect it, and then if it isn't detected, it like ambushes the players by bursting out of the water. Like it happens, it's a setup that occurs in more than one of these Elemental Evil modules, and I got no problem with it. It's great. I like it even more, honestly, with the fact that I was doing this whole winter theme, and I like the idea, especially of like Lacedons, you know, under the ice, bursting out of the ice, that sort of like White Walker imagery. But it's also like, that's also worth mentioning, is the fact that I had chosen to do this whole act of my campaign with a winter theme, and that doesn't really extend to the modules in this series. There are modules in the series that conveniently dealt with sort of a winter landscape because of their proximity to mountains or glaciers or being in the north, but they were generally more about like the elemental cults, which aren't sort of like they're season agnostic, as it were. Because, you know, you've got rock and fire and water everywhere, and air. But so in every case, I was sort of taking whatever the elemental thing was and then twisting it into, like, what is the sort of winter or ice version of that with the cult of Cryonax. And so, like, that's one of the things is, like, I had set up this idea that the elemental nodes could like completely turn a season on its head through their influence, because this campaign like featured sort of as its trappings, like a sticky humidity and a heat wave and like smells that hang in the air, like manure out in the sun. And I wanted to keep that flavor, but also have it in the this winter act, which I think like the juxtaposition made it all the more interesting. So they face the Lacedons and the flash flood in the sewers, And then they are contacted and receive aid from the Flumph that has survived the attack from the Cult of Cryonax, unlike the other one. And in the original module, this Flumph is actually the mate of the other Flumph. It's a tragic tale. Again, it's one of those things that I'm like, that's just a bummer, man. Like, I left that out of it. But I remember, I think I've mentioned this before, but like, I told my younger sister about that when I was planning to run the module, and she was like, I'm gonna run in during the session and be like, that's he's lying, they were lovers. Which I don't think she actually did, but I thought the idea was funny. Eventually, and with the help of the Flumph, they find the Cult of Cryonax fortified in the sewers. The cultists are attempting to access a forgotten Kuo-Toa tomb that is beneath the city in the sewers, far beneath the city of Arten. And so in this version, it was like the MPOC agents, Alzace, just saw the Cult of Cryonax, the Flumph that informed them who they were, and they just went into it, open combat with the cultists, and beat them pretty handily. It was a neat scene of like, they really used the sewer passes to their advantage in that Nessaly had the ability, what is it? Spike growth? It's like you make like an area full of thorns, and if enemies try to move through that area, not only is it difficult terrain, but they take damage for every like 5 feet they move through it. And so she could make like passages either impassable or like, you know, potentially fatal to people who tried to travel for them. So she could cut off any sort of escape or reinforcement routes the cultists had. Meanwhile, Chessie used her slippers of spider climb to literally just like walk up the wall of the sewer and then engage the enemies while upside down standing on the ceiling. So like, even if there were effects, like for example, the sewer trench itself not only held the risk of sewer plague, but it was also difficult terrain. But Chessie was able to just like completely ignore any sort of ground-based effect but like that by just running up the side of the wall and then coming at them fighting upside down and like stabbing at them, you know, upside down ways. Turn it flip ways, as my brother likes to say. And then, speaking of my brother, Ara Stormblast Kendor, he just wades out into as many cultists as he can, and he hits that destructive wave, slams his chaos maul to the ground, and a shockwave bursts out from him that can just, like, destroy multiple cultists at a time. So they made short work of these cultists. What was your experience with the... when you ran this, did you have the informant Flump? What was the situation with the cultists like? Also, I just want to say, I also really appreciate the detail, like, with all these elemental evil modules, there's a tendency for it to be like, this one, you're fighting the fire cult, this one, you're fighting the air cult, this one, you're fighting the water cult, and this one is technically a water cult one, but it also has this neat backstory for the leader of the cultists in the sewer, in that he was formerly part of the fire cult and has basically become like a turncoat within the politics of the elemental cults, which is just like a neat little trick. It also like changes up the combat beyond what the players would be expecting from the season, because he uses fire magic, whereas the rest of the water cults doesn't. And I just thought that it was like, it's cool because even though it has a lot of elemental evil flavor, it's a module that you can pick up and adapt very easily, because it's a fairly classic thing of like, a corpse turns up from the sewers, you go into the sewers, there's bad dudes up to something, and it turns out they're trying to get into an old haunted tomb. What more could you want?
When I ran it, to answer your question, the partner flumph was there. It wasn't like so much a group of cultists that I had. I sort of swapped out some of the monsters for the final encounter, because the plot when I was running it was that creatures were coming up from the Underdark. One of the characters in the campaign has escaped the Underdark and is trying to sort of leave his past there behind. But I wanted sort of a motif, like not an
just
ongoing...
Just like Driss Do'Urden.
Yeah, a bit like Driss Do'Urden, but I wanted it to be that no matter how hard he tries to get away from the Underdark, it always keeps sort of bubbling up around him. And so in this case, I did have the partner Flumph, who kind of helped guide them down there and explain the situation. But I really only had these two drow mages down there who were commanding the Kuo-Toa. The Kuo-Toa I wanted to make one of the primary threats. And then there was also a large creature sort of in a final pool area that I wanted the players to face off against. They dispatched with the mages very quickly, and then the Kuo-Toa became like the primary focus. They killed some of them, and there was a warlock in the party, and he wound up kind of making the Kuo-Toa think of him as a god. But I think they slayed a few more of them even after that.
It's also funny to mention because, you know, so in Ashes Against the Grain, I did Kuo-Toa, and you're saying Kuo-Toa now. But in the actual module, you don't run into any living Kuo-Toa. You run into troglodytes, which have held up the cultists.
Right.
There are some starving troglodytes that are effectively caught in an ongoing conflict with the with the cultists that they've sort of reached a stalemate at. And simply for, again, for like the flavor of Lilenia's backstory in Ashes Against the Grain, I had them as Kuo-Toa because I explicitly wanted Lilenia to then realize that she could speak telepathically with the Kuo-Toa and sort of make that connection with her backstory. But in that scenario as well, as we remember, what happened was you guys didn't realize at all who these cultists were, these bad guys. And they weren't cultists. They were like treasure, like grave robbing mercenaries, basically tomb raiders. But, you guys initially sort of like, initially you were in combat with them. Then you sort of parlayed, then they cut a deal with you to like, help us deal with these Kuo-Toa and we'll give you a split of the rewards. And of course, if you had actually helped them, they would have just killed you as soon as the way was clear. You know, these things, they're easy. They write themselves, basically. But
I fully admit to only including Kuo-Toa because you did, and I really liked the flavor of them.
Yeah, well, and I love to do my blah, 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 yeah, blah,
you love
blah,
the chant, but what I really love is just the idea that they might worship you as a god if you do the right thing. I think that there's, like, endless potential for comedy there. Certainly wound up being a lot of comedy surrounding that in my campaign.
Another thing that I know I've mentioned on the podcast before, but it's something I had come up with that I included once again in this module, is I had among the cultists of Cryonax, there was a warlock of Cryonax who had the ability Eldritch Snakes, which I had discussed before. So Eldritch Blast is like your go-to D10 120 range force attack cantrip for a warlock, and then warlocks can use invocations to improve it in various ways, make it Eldritch Spear so it has longer range, or like Eldritch I can't remember the other one, but there's one that like knocks them back. Agonizing Blast makes it so that you do extra damage. But I came up with my own version, which is Eldritch Snakes, which is basically a version of Eldritch Blast where when you fire it, it becomes like a constricting, like magical constricting snakes come out of the hands of the caster. And so not only does it strike you with an Eldritch Blast, but it can also grapple you at a distance. which isn't like restrained is much worse, but grapple, I still like, I think that grappling someone just like does enough to get the idea across that it's like you get hit by an Eldritch Blast, but it's no ordinary Eldritch Blast because now you can't move until you break free from these Eldritch Snakes. But like I said, the players wiped out these cultists fairly easily. And then I had the troglodytes just being like feral, basically. The players had to then fight their way through the troglodytes. And of course, the Flumph, who I had named Una, and also the leader of the cultists was named Jay. Una helped them along through the tomb. They got to the point where they had to take the water from the pool guarded by the water weird and put it in the mouths of the carved fish heads. If they didn't do it in time, it would spray them with acid, but they did it all in time. It was fine. And that takes them through an underwater tunnel that leads out to the tomb of the Koatoa, where they fight some awesome skeletal Kuotoa. I love that idea of like the skeletal guardians of the Kuotoa tomb. And then, even beyond that, you've got a slippery bridge of stepping stones across a whirlpool full of piranhas to get to an island of caustic purple sand with sarcophagus on it. And even when you open the sarcophagus, you gotta save versus the Blessed Lungs curse, which I like. It's a Kuotoa curse that makes your lungs fill with water. It's like a bubble forms around your head and all of a sudden you're drowning even though you're not even underwater. Blessed Lungs, classic Kuotoa trick. What did you think of all this, McGill?
I like skeletal Kuotoa. It's like a bunch of fish skeletons, like, you know, from a cartoon.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what did you do for this stuff? Or did you do all this stuff?
I didn't do the follow-up. I was dealing with a pretty big group of players, and I wanted to keep it fairly short. So I had most of the first part of the module I kept intact, where City Guard enlists them to help investigate the appearance of this weird monster corpse in the sewer. And then the players went down into the sewer, and they had encounters with the Lacedons. And then they came upon like a chamber with a big pool that had a fissure in it. And the fissure was the thing that led to the Underdark. It was like an opening to the Underdark that creatures were coming out of. And it was in that big chamber with the pool that they found the sort of drow mages commanding a group of Kuotoa. And unbeknownst to them, when they entered that room, there was also a big sort of aquatic creature in the water that they would have to fight later. But that's basically where I stopped following the module, is they get to that point and then there's like a big final battle and then they return topside and they've sort of solved the mystery of where this corpse is. But the bigger problem, of course, is that there's now an opening to the Underdark in the sewers under their city.
So the last thing from this module that I really want to highlight is a piece of treasure that you can get from that sarcophagus. In the original module, it is a +1 Rod of the Pack Keeper with the following description. This rod is always covered in a thin layer of slippery, foul-smelling slime. Whenever it is drawn or picked up, the creature doing so must succeed on a DC 10 dexterity saving throw or drop it. I, in my version, because the players were much higher level, I made it a +2 Rod of the Pack Keeper, and I named it the Slimy Stick. And I treated the Slimy Stick feature as a curse, but man, I love that Slimy Stick. I think it's like the greatest idea for like a Kuotoa treasure. Although, after the operation, when the players got back, the players, first of all, they got a little medical exam to make sure they hadn't contracted the dangest sewer plague, but also they received another cursed item as treasure. Or rather, it wasn't that they received it. It was that Dax at the armory was like, "Hey, I have this. I don't know if you guys want it." And they were like, "Nah, you can keep it in the armory." but it's a shield of missile attraction, which is a shield that basically, it's like a magnet for enemy ranged attacks. There's a not cursed version that's, I think, the shield of missile catching or something. It's something else, but like it's the one where you can block attacks rather than just like pulling all of them towards you.
I feel like I could find a use for the cursed version. You wait until the enemies all fire their missile attacks, and then you just throw the shield like a frisbee at them.
I think that also in Sugar Thane's Sanctum, I included, I can't remember if it was the cursed one or not, but my version was a sticky lollipop shield version that like everything would get stuck in. Big swirly lollipop shield. Anyways, so that was Operation Winterfrost. The whole dangus thing. I don't really have anything for the tavern today because I already talked about the crystal shard and foulness beneath Mole Master.
Well, speaking of foulness, Tom,
I don't know about this.
Tavern.
I told you.
You're just trying to skip past it. But no, man. I found my tavern pick is I found the D&D 5th edition rules about farts. That's right. Somebody bothered to do this. This is not an official Wizards of the Coast release. It is a third-party supplement that I found on dmsguild.com, a product of the D&D Character Lab. And I'm just going to read you some rules for farts. Because you know what? I know you sort of, you think this is pretty lowbrow, and it is, but I feel like maybe this would be of use to goblins. I feel like goblins might have use for some of these fart rules.
I wonder if these rules would be compatible with my idea to bring over the magic whoopee cushion spells from that Riff's Ludicrous supplement.
Hey, maybe. Well, here. So, farting. Even beings of godlike power still have the natural bodily functions. These optional rules have been painstakingly crafted to add immersion to your game of the foulest kind. But please consult your DM before farting, and if there was ever a part of the game you should never emulate in real life, this is it. This might seem like a no-brainer, but if you've played D&D for more than a minute, you know there is a rule and a role for everything. You may use your reaction to fart a number of times equal to your constitution modifier, minimum of one, before you must finish a short or long rest. Any fart that forces a save uses a DC that is equal to 8 plus your proficiency plus your con modifier. So what I'll do is there are different kinds of farts. That
the idea of being proficient in flatulence is so, oh my god.
this is dumb. Look, I'm not going to pretend that this is in any way some kind of great intellectual supplement. So, optional rule, safety. This is where we're getting really lowbrow. Not every fart exit alone. We're talking about poop. Whenever you choose your fart, your DM can force a safety save. On failure, you poop your pants, which lowers your move speed by 5 feet and gives you disadvantage on concentration checks until you clean yourself up during a short or long rest. There is a safety DC under each type of fart, and you can add your con modifier to the roll to save. So here are the seven different kinds of farts that you can employ. The crack rattler. Safety DC 10. It erupts from your backside like the mournful cry of a tarrasque.
I'm just shaking my head here.
Spellcasters of your choice within 30 feet that can hear you must immediately make a concentration check to maintain any spell that requires concentration. There's the Rudy Tootie Pip Pop Brap. Safety DC 10. A quirky toot. This fart is sure to bring a smile to even the sourest of faces. You have advantage on charisma checks until the end of your next turn for all creatures within 30 feet that can hear you.
Not me.
Crack people up. Silent but deadly. Safety DC 13. A stench crawls forth from your abyssal guts. All creatures within 10 feet must succeed on a constitution save or become poisoned until the end of their next turn. See, that seems like the kind of thing a goblin might do. Squeaker. Safety DC 13. A high-pitched poot so shrill, beasts are disturbed by it. All beasts within 30 feet must succeed on a constitution save or have disadvantage on attacks until the end of their next turn. The ululating howl, safety DC 15. Not only does the sound invoke the cry of death itself, but it seems to go over long after all gases have escaped your body. Creatures of your choice within 30 feet must succeed on a wisdom save or become frightened by you until the end of your next turn. Garbage guts. Safety DC 18. The smell defies explanation in a world of magic, and that's saying something. Even you can't believe how bad this is. All creatures within 20 feet, including yourself, must succeed on a con save or become poisoned until the end of your next turn and take poison damage equal to 1d6 plus your con modifier. And then finally,
oh my God.
The mudslide. Automatic fail for safety. You know this is going to turn ugly. Sometimes sacrifices must be made. Your booty unleashes a torrent of sloth that creates difficult terrain within 10 feet of you.
I don't like it.
And then finally, one other optional rule. Doorknob. After you fart, any creature within 5 feet that has hands can use the reaction to punch you in the arm for 1 bludgeoning damage.
Opportunity attack with all that poison going around. I've got the rules here.
Safety and doorknob. You recognize those things?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's one of those schoolyard games, right?
Yeah.
I haven't thought about that in forever.
All this, I can't believe I'm going to a Palladium product for the more highbrow result. But whoopee cushion sleep. All the whoopee cushions have a cool saving throw effect, which is special. If the victim sits and save versus magic, then it doesn't disperse its charge, but is saved for the next person. We got whoopee cushion sleep. The character places the magically created cushion in an undisclosed place, preferably a place for sitting. When the victim sits on the cushion, the victim hears a strong sound followed by laughter. The victim must roll under their MA or be embarrassed by the sound. All eyes within a 30-foot area will look to see where the sound came from and begin snickering. The victim must then save versus magic or fall asleep as per the spell sleep. Or fart lesser. Similar to whoopee cushion sleep, with this exception, the cushion still releases a surprising explosion sound followed by a smell similar to a skunk. The character will reek, but only they will smell it. Similar to the old adage, the smeller is the feller. That's not the way it goes. The character will be constantly distracted by the smell, may even puke, save versus non-lethal poison. And then, whoopee cushion fart greater. This spell is similar to lesser, only this time the spell affects those around the victim and the victim smells nothing. The penalties still apply, but now those within the area effect plus 20 feet must save versus magic. Those who fail will feel nauseous and may vomit.
See, how is this any worse than what I just read out? Or any better?
Because yours said slop coming of a booty.
Yeah, okay, I'll give you that one, Tom.
The wording was like so much worse. All those names and stuff, my God. My God. Anyways. So that was another episode. Episode 77, in fact, recorded on the 10th of September, 2021. I didn't really have much of a tavern pick, but that's okay, because we had all sorts of things to talk about.
Sure you did. You had a book review at the start and a whoopee cushion at the end.
A few whoopee cushions. If you want to get in touch with us, follow us, see when we post our new episodes, check us out on Facebook, Comparing and Campaign on Facebook. And if you want to see our supplemental materials, follow along with our notes or my doodles or things that we talk about and then we link to, check us out on comparingcampaign.wordpress.com. We've got the sticky post now, which is a map of Drail right where it should be. Apart from that, anything else? Not me. Anything else?
Oh, level up. Level up your characters.
Okay.
Get that ding.
The end.
Safety.
Ba-ba-da-ba.
Door knob.
Ba-ba-da-ba. Ba-ba-da-ba. Not me.